Welcome to the Food Matters Live podcast, where we showcase the innovations, the big ideas, and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep, we look to the future and the past, and we question everything that we think we know about food. I'm Stefan Gates. I'm a food science writer, TV presenter, and gastronaut. Today, we're looking at the impact of shift work on nutrition. Anyone who's worked irregular hours knows that the world is built around regular daytime eating times, not just in the home, but at shops, cafes, restaurants and canteens. But there are millions of people working rotating shifts, night shifts, irregular hours. And when the shops are shut, all too often, the only food available is nutritionally poor and expensive, things like snacks and packet food. Let's face it, eating from vending machines at dark, deserted bus stations isn't a great recipe for a happy, healthy life. Shift work has long been associated with negative health outcomes, but does when we eat matter as much as what we eat? And is it really possible to separate the two? What can shift workers do to make healthy lifestyle choices? And what solutions could the food industry offer? To discuss this, I'm joined by two absolutely fantastic guests. Dr. Sally Wilson is Principal Research Fellow at the Institute for Employment Studies and has decades of experience in conducting research into workplace health and well-being. Hello there, Sally. How are you doing?
Hi, good to meet you.
Great to meet you too. We've also got Professor Alexandra Johnson from the Rowett Institute at the University of Aberdeen, where she studies the field of human appetite control. Hello there, Alex.
Hi, Stefan. Yes, it's really nice to be invited back to speak again. Thank you.
That's a great pleasure to have you both on. And now, okay, Sally, let's start with you. Millions of people do shift work. That number's increasing. Work patterns are changing enormously. For people working in shifts, what are the main challenges in terms of finding healthy food?
I'd say there's a range of challenges that fall into probably three main categories. I'm coming at this from the perspective of having conducted a study in the rail industry, looking at workers doing shift work in roles such as engineering on the railway lines, and also train drivers, including freight train drivers who drive at night as well as during the day. Time is obviously an issue. If you're working shift work, you're deviating from the normal times you might sit down and have a healthy meal with the rest of your household. So there's some disruption to what you might normally eat, and if you like, so-called healthy or regular patterns of eating. There's issues, as you've mentioned, Stefan, around the shops being shut. So there's availability of food and the opportunities to buy food of your choosing during your working time and when you take breaks. There's also issues about place and where you are. And I think for our study in the rail industry, we were looking at workers on the move. So in particular, thinking about rail engineers doing those repairs at night, they weren't necessarily near places to buy food. And also because you're often doing the repairs in quite remote locations at night, you're not near any shops, you know, regardless of the time of day. You're working very remotely from anywhere. And apart from that, even if you were to say, you know, bring a can of soup with you, there's nowhere to prepare food or heat food. So we encountered issues like that about the inconvenience of location. And then the other thing would be around, I suppose, appetite and craving, which Alex will probably be able to talk about in more detail than me. But thinking about the populations we looked at, these were people often working in quite challenging environmental conditions. So, for example, you know, in cold weather, in the dark, quite high levels of manual work. So people genuinely feeling tired, needing an energy boost, craving comfort food, working in groups where work could be a kind of social thing as a kind of reward at the end of the shift. So that would influence eating choices. And I think just that general feeling of tiredness and fatigue that can drive people towards certain types of food over others can affect the quality of diet.
And do you find many employers making significant attempts to intervene to tackle these problems?
I would say no. I'd say it is quite difficult for employers to intervene because of the days of the old workplace canteen are kind of we're kind of into a newer environment now where, again, thinking about the rail industry, where there would often be canteens, for example, at rail depots. Those aren't really there anymore, and they've been replaced by, I suppose, rest areas with vending machines. So what employers can do to intervene is probably more limited than it used to be. So no, and I think in conducting the study for the rail industry and Standards Board, they were actually doing something quite new and innovative in trying to shine a spotlight on the problem.
Mm-hmm. I guess shining a spotlight and solving it is two slightly different things, but shining the spotlight is a start, isn't it? Now, shift work has been associated with negative health outcomes, particularly night shifts, as you mentioned. Why? What is the significant factor, and how important is diet to all of this?
I'm not a medic, but what I do know about shift work is it's very disruptive to the body's circadian rhythm, and that can make people more at risk of issues such as cardiovascular disease, obesity, gastrointestinal issues. And then there's other issues as well, like risk of having accidents as a result of tiredness and that kind of, I say, that disruption to normal routines. The actual contribution of food, of diet, hasn't, as far as I know, really been quantified. So it's bound to have a role. And what I would say is that the rail industry do all they can to mitigate the health effects of shift work, but they wanted to look at diet and the environmental aspect of food and its availability because they felt that was something they could do more about.
Well, let's get into the detail of why this is happening. So, Alex, let's bring in this idea of eating at the right time, chrononutrition. Can you tell us a little bit more about chrononutrition?
Sure. So, chrononutrition is quite a new science, and it's simply combining the traditional science of circadian rhythms. And remember, circa means around a day. So our body has natural biological rhythms. So it's combining that and time or time of day to look at how time of day influences health. So it's meal timing, nutrient intake, snacking across the day and throughout the night, and how that can impact on health and well-being.
Now, what happens to our metabolism when we work a night shift then, when we have breakfast in the evening, lunch at 3 a.m, dinner at 8 a.m? I've done occasional weeks of night work, and it was disastrous for me in terms of happiness, in terms of, and concepts of diet just kind of went out the window. Alex, have you done any night shift work?
No, I've not done night shift work myself, but I think what we need to make a distinction here is that there are people who habitually work night shift, and they will habituate over a period of time to that night shift experience. So humans and our working life is really set up that we are active during the light cycle and eating during that cycle and sleeping during the dark cycle and resting and not eating. So you get a disruption of that system when you're working changing shifts. And that's what we would often see, for example, in the medical profession, when there's on-call late shifts and then you're expected to sleep the next day and then perhaps have a period of time off and then back to a day shift and then switch to night shift. So when we're thinking about people who are engaged in irregular work patterns, then you get disruption between the natural circadian rhythm and the external influences that regulate that rhythm. And of course, food intake and eating is what we call an environmental influence. So having regular sleep patterns, having regular eating patterns is very beneficial for our health in terms of regulating these circadian rhythms. To put that in context, we know that our blood sugar, our blood glucose, has a natural circadian rhythm. The release of insulin to control blood glucose has a natural circadian rhythm. We're more insulin sensitive in the morning and less sensitive in the evening. So when you change all this, that can lead to disruption. And another two analogies I just want to touch on is that, of course, people can possibly relate to jet lag. So those of us that are not engaged with shift work can think about how we feel when we fly across different time zones and appear in a time zone, and your body feels like you're in one time, but you get that sort of hangover effect and gastrointestinal disturbance. Or even when we have busy days, there's something called social jet lag, that our eating patterns have changed, that we snack more, eat on the go more.
So how does that manifest itself then, Alex? So if we snack more and we're eating on the go, does that give us an example of the sort of thing? Does that mean we're literally reaching for different types of food than we would otherwise eat if we were if we had a more regulated pattern?
So yes, the food choices that we make when we're eating on the go are quite different as if we're sitting in a family or work canteen. And that foods are packaged and probably more likely to be processed, high in energy, high in fat, high in sugar, and perhaps less healthy than something if you sit down and make your own, let's say breakfast. And that's really interesting in terms of what could constitute a healthy breakfast, and then what role does the workplace have, you know, to promote healthy eating? Because, you know, some of us who are working full time perhaps eat two meals a day in our office environment, perhaps even sitting at a desk.
So Sally, would you say that this is manifested? I mean, it sounds like there are three different main elements here. There's the time of day, the environment that it's eaten in, and then the food type. Well, I suppose there's also the work type, and you were saying sort of out of doors or indoors, but I guess that's environment as well. Are they all as important or all as destructive in your analysis?
I would say the main factor for me is the availability of food. In our study, we talked to a lot of rail workers who wanted to eat well. So they had the motivation to do it, and they were largely aware of the relationship between what they ate and their health and their weight and their propensity to develop chronic conditions as they aged. So they were informed and largely motivated, but they lacked the opportunity to buy nutritious food. And there were also cost issues. When we conducted the research, it was before the current cost of living crisis, but certainly even back then cost came up as an issue. So unhealthy food has always been cheaper. And
yes, absolutely. But then on another level, you could say, well, making food yourself and bringing it into work would be cheaper. But what are the, is it, I mean, it's easily said, but that presumably there are lots of issues around that. I mean, bringing in your own food, is that not a potential solution to this?
Yeah, and I think particularly with train drivers, they brought along their own packed lunches because of lack of opportunity just to have breaks sometimes. You can imagine the nature of the job is the schedule breaks few and far between. But I think when you're working outdoors and it's cold, hot food and hot drinks are what people want, and flasks are only going to get you so far. As I say, people eat communally, so there tends to be people stopping. They might be in a van together, so stopping at a fast food joint to eat together. It's a social element of eating. Of course, you don't really quite get with a packed lunch. So I think there's other behavioural and social factors at play.
Yeah, I've been in many a van where we've stopped at a grubby fast food joint. and that's an important part of the rhythm of the day, especially if you're replacing the rhythm of a normal day with the rhythm of you as a group of people together, and you fall into it so easily. Now, I mean, shift work often crops up in industrial relations disputes. I mean, thinking about the RMT union disputes at the moment, which they're obviously keeping things a bit close to their chest in terms of exact issues to negotiate over. But shift patterns crop up again and again when we're talking about industrial relations. And I wonder if, I wonder if the public doesn't take on the enormity of the lifestyle impact of shift work, increasing shift work, changing shift work. I think the public often think, well, surely a bit of flexibility isn't the worst thing in the world, you know, the world's moving on. Do you find, Sally, that employers as well will often think, come on, we're just asking you to do a little bit of changing around of what's already a changing situation?
My experience is that employers are aware and they do what they can, and obviously we're all aware of people being paid time and a half or double time for covering antisocial shifts. So I think there's a desire to compensate in that way. I think the areas where it is harder to compensate are those wider environmental factors about availability of not just food, but also drink, opportunities to exercise, opportunities to use the loo sometimes, those things we take for granted that are part of a healthy lifestyle.
Okay, so Alex, let's go a little bit deeper into this, because the world is becoming ever more a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week system. It is bound to change. Does this just need to be another stage of human evolution, that we have to be able to cope with changing work patterns?
Well, I think society has changed, and since the Industrial Revolution, we've gone towards a sort of 24-hour, highly productive workforce. And the problem with that is that not all employers give protected time for eating. So Sally's mentioned some really fascinating, really useful insights in the rail industry, and I've done work in working with prison officers and fire responders, emergency responders, and if they are in a prolonged shout, then the fire service will provide catering arrangements for their firefighters, for example. But when I worked with ambulance responders, it was very much a case of what Sally said, you know, they had their packed lunch with them and they were eating on the go. So employers, I would encourage employers to think about the importance of diet and health and thinking about having protected time for eating where possible. And then the other area I think that I suppose we should mention is that we currently have no public health policy for guidance for shift workers in terms of diet. We have the Eat Well Guide, which is for adults in the UK, to give us general advice as to what to consume to promote good health. But actually what we need is evidence-based guidelines for shift workers to give them insights as to timing of eating and what and when to eat.
I mean, the Eat Well plate is I mean, put that to a rail worker on shift work and they'd laugh in your face.
Well, the Eat Well Guide is described as food groups. And we have to remember here that we don't eat food groups, we actually do eat food. And as Sally said, I'm totally with her about eating being a social experience, but how you apply that on an individual level in terms of constructing meals and snacks that are both healthy, environmentally sustainable and nutritious and enjoyable is very much driven by the individual and their own circumstances. So I think we do need guidance from public health, you know, particularly for shift workers.
Okay, well, I'm the new minister in charge of guidance for shift workers. Alex, what would you suggest that guidance should say?
So I want to give one bit of positive news, and that some of the recent research I've been doing with nutrition, I looked at the ability to lose weight with morning-loaded calories versus evening-loaded calories. And the good news is that we found that our volunteers, when we use controlled diets and controlled gold standard measurements of energy expenditure, were able to lose weight regardless of the time of day that they were eating. So I want to share that as good news because it suggests that those that are engaged with shift work, there is no reason to uphold the myth that eating at different times of the day inhibits weight loss.
Mm. Well, that is really exciting, actually. It's a good start to work on, isn't it?
Yes, yeah, so that is brilliant. And I think that there, you know, of course, there's a lot of anecdotal reports, but exploding these myths is, I think, incredibly important for my role as a researcher. So the other bit of really interesting insight that I gained from this research in terms of timely eating is that eating breakfast meant that people were, our volunteers were much better able to control appetite throughout the rest of the day. And that's really interesting because it would suggest to me that for shift workers, who are engaged in night shift, that they'd be better off consuming calories during the morning period to enable them to better control appetite throughout the rest of the day. So this is something we need probably more research on. It's a bit cliche to say that, but actually this science is quite new. It's evolving, and really we do have a cohort of clock clubbers, as we call ourselves, people who are interested in circadian rhythm and clock timing and how to positively influence health.
Love clock clubbers. Okay, that's going to come up again and again. Sally, can you add to this? So we're writing up the shift work legislation regarding nutrition. What would you like to see happening? And some specifics maybe as well about what employers should maybe be asked to do.
Well, I'd certainly echo what Alex says about a guidance. So that being guidance available for employers, but also to employees. I think that guidance also obviously needs to be inclusive. So it needs to be inclusive in terms of guidance for people who might eat differently for cultural or religious reasons, people who are on particular types of diet or have allergies or intolerances, and people who have diabetes. And you can imagine if you have diabetes, it's very, very hard to get hold of food in the middle of the night that fits your dietary requirements. So I think guidance is important, but the guidance won't work unless the environment is conducive to following that guidance. So I think there's a role, whether it's for government or not, is debatable. But I think if you think about, for example, station concourses late at night, is when only a certain amount of outlets are open and perhaps some of those selling healthier food are shut. So there's some role there for guidelines or efforts from individual employers to maybe lobby station concourses or shopping centres or supermarkets. Maybe some of that power is with the public or with employers to actually campaign for these issues and ensure that workers have more choice.
Mm. I mean, it seems to me that a lot of this would come down to the concept of vending machines and them being transformed. Am I right in thinking that, Sally?
Yeah, vending machines are a massive issue because I think we're all conscious that they're everywhere now. And that they're full of food that's loaded with preservatives for obvious reasons. And, you know, most healthy food needs to be chilled. It needs more sophisticated vending machine apparatus, which is generally more expensive. So vending machines with healthy content do exist, but they require investment. And I think, there might be some scope there for companies or particular industries trialing different kinds of vending machines to see, A, if they're used, and B, do they see any noticeable changes in habits or health changes in their workers?
And this, I mean, for me, this is a food industry podcast, and so I'm thinking, come on, guys, there's got to be some innovations around this. You know, chilling food in a vending machine isn't the worst thing in the world to come up with, because you have enormous amounts of chilled drinks in vending machines. I know that it's not quite as simple as that, but surely, is there just not quite a market enough for this, or are stations, for instance, too obsessed with getting the money from a concession that is serving fresh food in the daytime, and they won't get enough money from a vending machine that might serve something a bit healthier? What do you think, Sally? Is there something holding the vending machine industry back?
I would imagine part of it is about the frequency which you have to take away expired food and replace it. So it's not just about the cost of the food inside it, it's about the service charges and resources required. So I expect there's quite a lot of structural issues. And I think, again, it's about demand and perhaps some employers speaking up and saying this is what they want, employer bodies, even trade unions. And actually, if there is a demand, then vending machine manufacturers, you would imagine, would find, as you say, ways of meeting that.
Mm. So, Alex, what about if there was some sort of subsidy with this? I mean, the thing that springs to mind for me is nurses on night shifts, and you know, there has been a fair amount of talk about the fact that there's just nothing available for overnight workers. I mean, should employers or should the government be subsidising these things or allowing some tax breaks on vending machines so that specific workers can get access to better food?
Yeah, so in Scotland, within the hospital setting, they have been forced to provide a higher proportion of healthier eating products for a more prolonged period throughout the day. So, I mean, I think that has had a very positive influence in terms of the range of products that are available to staff. And, yeah, the food sector do need to listen in terms of consumer demand, but at the end of the day, it is an individual's choice what they're going to choose to eat. So
yeah. Okay, well, let's look at the individual then. Is there other advice that can be offered to shift workers to try and help them get better health outcomes from eating in, you know, challenged timings, Alex?
There's a few things to consider here. We've talked a lot about food industry, but don't forget beverages and maintaining hydration. I think it's really complex to think about shift work because some of these employment schedules are quite stressful. So it'd be interesting to understand if those that are engaged in shift work are better able to deal with stressful situations. or those that are stressed? Does that also lead to food choices that are less healthy and more about the reward mechanisms? I think that promoting good sleep patterns is incredibly important, because we know that sleep is disrupted through shift patterns. And how can we think about the role of diet in promoting good sleep? So these are all highly innovative, you know, areas that I don't have the answers for, but I feel sure that, you know, in the future, you know, there will be more research to think about, you know, these really complex interactions. And I suppose the last area I want to touch on, which is also quite topical, is time-restricted eating. Because I know the Sachin Panda and the Salk Institute in the US, they've just published some really interesting work on what they call the Healthy Heroes study. So it was in firefighters, showing that time-restricted eating, so having a time eating window of only 10 hours, did promote better health in these firefighters. So now that can be practically difficult to achieve, but it's really interesting that the science is telling us, or giving us some clues at least, you know, some of the eating patterns that can help promote health for these people who are engaged in shift work.
That is fascinating. Okay, and what about availability? So, Sally, you know, change is hard. If we're trying to get people to eat better, let's posit the scenario where other food is available. Have you found that shift workers can actually make changes if healthier options are more easily available?
As part of the study that we did for the rail industry, we did a review of studies in other similar industries. So, for example, truck drivers or other types of jobs where workers are on the move. In general, if you do take steps to make healthier food more available, then workers will generally benefit from that. I think that the key thing that came through was what you need to do is have a joined up approach, so that workers are receiving kind of guidance and information they need to make choices, as well as changes to their environment that make those choices possible. And for example, I'm just thinking of a solution within the rail industry. There's increased use of what are called welfare vans with kitchen facilities inside them. So for example, you know, then workers can bring foods of their choice to work and have an opportunity to heat them up in remote places. So it's thinking outside of the box, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, this is a food industry podcast. Lots of our listeners run food companies. I mean, this must be an opportunity. As, you know, with every problem, it should be seen as an opportunity. What would you like to see the food industry doing? We talked a little bit about vending machines, but are there other innovations? You know, should we make ready meals or snacks better? Or start creating snacks for shift workers? Sally, do you think there's scope there?
I definitely think there are. And I think, you know, supermarkets are open late at night, for example, and workers tend to go for meal deals. And it's thinking about what those meal deals can comprise of, and the price point of those meal deals as well. So I think there's definitely things the industry can do in that way. But I think it is just generally thinking about the availability of particular sorts of vendors at different times of day in different locations. Yeah, there's definitely opportunities, I think. One of our suggestions was that in local areas, flyers for local takeaways that provided slightly healthier food could be pinned up on staff notice boards. Or, for example, they could be invited to bring mobile vans to sites where several shift workers work at a particular time. So I think there's opportunities there, and I think there's room for changes. There's definitely potential, yeah.
Alex, are there opportunities for? I mean, I have to say, I've done a hell of a lot of long distance driving recently for some bizarre reason. I've had to drive a lot, and I've gone into late night either petrol stations or late night supermarkets and looked at it and gone, there's absolutely naff all here that I want to eat. What I need is a massive, great salad, full of lots of good stuff, and not some poxy little pot of greens. I just want something with a bit more guts to it. I mean, is the food industry just not providing the stuff that's needed for shift workers?
So I think that there are two viewpoints here, that, and we started the conversation with this, that shift workers do have preferred types of foods that they want to consume. So there's one aspect is the consumer demand, but if we focus entirely on what the food industry can offer, then I think we need to think about portion sizes. And the reason I say that is, unfortunately, because we're in the middle of an obesity epidemic. Now, because not all shift workers are engaged in manual work, some of them are actually quite sedentary. And the scenario you described there about, you know, distance driving, then I think we do need to think about portion sizes in terms of having products that are both satiating, so they're filling, nutritious, environmentally sustainable, but also something that consumers would want to purchase and, importantly, repeat purchase, because that's what it's all about for the food sector, is having consumers wanting to buy these products again and again. So fresh products are incredibly difficult, because Sally touched on food waste there. We don't want to be giving out advice that doesn't really comply to, you know, a healthy body and a healthy planet. So we need to think about when products are coming out of date, what's going to happen to that. So packaging is probably really important here as well, that foods can be stored in different formats, that they can be consumed, eating on the go to fulfil that sort of snackification society. You know, there are really a whole host of different approaches that we can take here in different workplace settings. And, you know, the employees and employers need to be working together to meet in the middle, to think about what solutions are practical in their own, what I call micro environment, in their own workplace setting. So it's not as simple as me saying, well, one approach fits all. Unfortunately, I think we've probably touched on different settings where different solutions are going to be viable.
Yeah. And Sally, do you think that what's required here is for employers to spend more money, or is it actually a change of mindset? Because with every change and every bit of care that needs to be shown to employees, employers often take a hit, and at some point it just can't. There's nothing left to give. Is it just a change of attitude, or you mentioned that the rail companies, you know, are concerned about this, and you know, that they're not stuck in the past, but this has to obviously manifest itself in change, and change often costs money.
I don't think necessarily has to cost money. I think companies that are an advantage, if, for example, they have an occupational health professional among their workforce who can kind of lead on new ideas. So, for example, if you're based on an industrial park and there are a lot of workers based there overnight, then maybe alert local companies as an opportunity for them to park their van there and sell their produce. So I think there's things that can be done just in terms of, as I say, thinking outside the box and generating ideas and thinking about what's local to you that doesn't necessarily involve financial investment.
Yeah, fair enough. And Alex, finally, we're fascinated by you clock clubbers. And so can you tell us a little bit more about what else we have to learn from Cronin Nutrition? Is there more research that's come out recently? Is there more research being carried out at the moment? What are the next exciting discoveries to be made in this area? Because it's so important, I think, to shift workers as well.
So I think it's about thinking about mechanisms and understanding some of the controllers of some of these metabolic consequences. So, for example, we are planning some new research on shift workers, thinking about timing of exercise and timing of food intake to optimise that, to look at health parameters. So, unfortunately, yes, when we look at the literature, that late eating does not tend to promote good health. It gives risk for metabolic consequences like diabetes and obesity. So really thinking about solutions about giving diet advice, it's evidence-based, how to counteract that. So, I think in the UK, I think we're perhaps maybe slightly behind the US. I think there are more studies that are coming out from there in terms of the role of, you know, a multidisciplinary team, whether it's academics, policy, employees, employers coming together. So I'm a great believer in co-production in terms of working together to come up with these solutions. So
Fantastic. Okay, well, I think there's a lot of exciting stuff to unfold. But also I think this subject is going to become more and more important as working patterns change so much. So I think we've delved into it really well. And thank you so much for your expertise, Sally Wilson and Alex Johnson. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did, there are hundreds more at foodmatterslive.com. Remember, if you enjoy the Food Matters Live podcast, you can subscribe via your preferred platform. And if you feel inclined, go on, leave us a review. Thank you so much for listening.